Seeing this presentation, I was very struck by the diversity of approaches and concerns and different aspects of history and reality that as artists and curators, women are working with, and how enormous the task of art is, especially in the context that we have been speaking about it this morning and this afternoon. One of the main themes that came up in this afternoon's discussion is the asserting and losing control over our own bodies, and I think that really was the strongest undercurrent that came up in each of the presentations today. So without further ado, we're going to go to questions if anyone would like to get started.
Hi, I'm Carrie Lovelace again. Just quickly before I ask my question, I just wanted to, something I didn't say this morning was that there's been a lot of talk about historicizing the 70s, and I just finished the first volume of a two-volume history of feminist art. So I, you know, ask me for the manuscript, find me a publisher, and but no.
Could
my name is
hear
Carrie
that?
Lovelace. Anyway, but I just wanted to, just to say, I'm sorry, it's so embarrassing to do that, but I, just to say that there is an effort that's been happening to, you know, to historicize these things. It's not, they're not going unrecorded, just so that you know that, so that everyone can be relaxed about that. So my question is for Geeta Kapoor. I thought what you were, I thought your comments of the artists that you spoke about were really wonderful, and I know also another artist, Tejal Shah, who's also dealt with issues of the body. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about other women in India, perhaps dealing with the same subject matter, and both within Hindu and Islamic traditions.
Sorry, say that again?
Other women in India dealing with
and,
those.
And last, what about him? What did you say last?
With both, within the artist, you presented one artist who was dealing within the Hindu tradition, another artist in the within the Islamic tradition, so I was just interested in both of those spheres.
I'll start with the end, the last point that you make, that they work within the Islamic or the Hindu. The point I was trying to make is precisely not. And I'd like to elaborate on that, because if that was what was conveyed, then I need to. And if it was, if it appears like that, I don't think it's an individual misunderstanding. It's the assumptions of Western assumptions with regard to societies like ours, that they would be inevitably, that it would have to be seen in binary terms if there are different communities or in multiple terms, and that there would be contestations. Now, I have very deliberately foregrounded the contestation, but the premise from which the argument was being made and the premise on which the Indian women artists or Indian artists would tend to work would be a premise which actually works away from the polarity that is created within the was created within the colonial mind, and which is, if I might say so, recreated by imperialism. And therefore, if a national construct like that of India, and it's a construct which is constantly under test and constantly thereby also failing, but also struggling to achieve a certain kind of understanding of citizenship, then it would be not in terms of being a Hindu and a Muslim artist, but testing the grounds of that identity as against the identity of a citizen. So first I would like to suggest that I'm not speaking in terms of somebody exploring one tradition and another. The question prior to that is about other women artists. There are, just as a matter of statement, without valorizing this situation in any special way, there are a very prominent number of women artists, and they happen, I would imagine, as a group, one would say they are nearest to being the most cutting edge, both in terms of the content that they address as well as in the mediums that they undertake. So these two were examples that I took because I wanted to make a point about the testing of identity rather than the claiming and embodying of identity. And there was a very particular reason why I took this. It so happens that Romana is Muslim, was Muslim, Navjot is Hindu and married to a Muslim, but that was not, in fact, the point. Romana was testing it against the fact that she was going to have to assume this identity, and she was making a dialectical relationship with that demand, which is a demand on a citizen, not a demand on an ethnic origin. Sorry?
I guess it's my turn now. my name is Michaela. I'm a recent graduate of Mills College. And Martha, I'm familiar with your work mainly through the recent show and publication, Persistent Vestiges, which was put together by Catherine DeZager and Moira Roth of Mills. And I've just been very drawn to your Bringing the War Home series, both the original about Vietnam and the current series that you're undertaking. And I was very moved by the juxtaposition of both your work and current anti-war artists with work from artists who had traveled with the Viet Cong and the Persistent Vestiges show. And I'm just wondering if you could comment at all on both that project and if you know of any other artists working in your vein, and particularly Iraqi artists who might be, you might perhaps be in dialogue with your project?
Well, first of all, it's not my tradition, it's the common tradition of photomontage, and I am an inheritor of a tradition which is venerable and also is a quintessential and symptomatic tradition of the 20th century and up into the present. So just let me say that. I am not in contact with other people working this way, but if you go online, you can see many, 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 many montages that call upon precisely that notion of the intersection of diverse presence, diverse time and space continua that, in fact, are divided only by ideological divisions. I also was very moved by the inclusion in Persistent Vestiges alongside Nancy Spiro and Din Kyu Lee and the artists who, as you say, traveled with the Viet Cong, which is had the poignant attribute of incorporating a kind of French Beaux-Arts tradition in the delegate watercolors that were the second to the agitational montages, which is how I saw my work as agitational. And I would like to say that the work that I did, the Bringing the War Home series, A, was not a series when I did it. It was one by one by one. It was an idea, and it was not art. It was not intended as art, because although I felt that I was making them as an artist, that they, in fact, were agitational works and did not circulate in the art world. It's perhaps a little off your question and a little bit too annoying for the audience for me to go into why the current set circulates within the art world. But that was actually a difficult choice for me. But I think the internet is precisely the right place to look for contributions by people. Surely you saw during Katrina the two images of Bush Père and Bush Fils strumming guitars and so on while New Orleans drowned. So this is a part of the reason that I have worked with this tradition is the same reason that my videos also look as, shall we say, crude and as they do, which is that I am very much wanting to say, cheap media is good media. You can do this too.
Great,
thank you.
Just I was wondering if Marina and Beatrice would also comment about Marina, one about your redoing performances from an earlier period, and if there's any relationship between your work with the Balkan Epic series. Just
There's no relation at all.
No, but
it's completely different work.
To talk about history, and not only the redoing of history, but the relationship of history to the current time, and what the Baltic Epic series has to do with them.
It's not Baltic, it's Balkan.
Balkan, I'm sorry.
Big difference.
Different place, I understand. Excuse me.
I always come with a concept, and then I use different materials. Seven Easy Pieces was really about reenacting performances from the 70s, and I have different reasons for that. Balkan Erotic Epic was really to look into the sexual organs in different way as we perceive them today, through television, through magazines. It's always some kind of vulgar, pornographic way of exploitation of the woman, and you never see the really man in the same way I'm showing it. So I really wanted to explore my own culture, look into this, the pagan culture, the ritualistic the ceremonies, when you can see in the villages in all over the Balkan, and I'm sure there is some of this stuff here too, and then just reenactment today in this context of 21st century, and as you see, there is lots of vaginas and lots of penises, but they don't look vulgar and they don't look pornographic. It's just about something else. So I want to give them that kind of spiritual meaning that actually the sex lost it. So that was a really important thing for me for the Balkan Erotic Epic. And the Seven Easy Pieces is completely another story, is that, I'm one of these artists from the 70s, and I'm just fed up with the copying of not just my work, but work of all the artists from the 70s in different ways, in MTV, in theater, in dance, in fashion, in young artists, and also fed up with young critics who actually evaluate the young artist's work and tell us the original without referring to the past works at all, like they didn't exist. So they deny history. And I felt that, as I'm one of the few artists from that generation still performing, that I really, really wanted to make kind of history straight before I die and see what really is happening with the performance. So can we reenact per piece? Can we really see if performance can live just as a dead material in the books and the documentation of bad video projections, because we didn't have better in the time? Or there is a way how we can reenact performance and make it live, because I personally believe the performance can be live only if it's reperformed and not any other way. But if this is done, in which conditions are, how we can deal with that. And then I propose, first of all, ask artists for permission, or the real estate of artist's debt for permission of the state who is presenting it, then pay for permission, like you pay for the book, for any other material, music and so on, and then understand the original material and do your version. And that way, performance can have the second chance to live. So Seven Easy Pieces was about that. And the Balkan Erotic Epicos is really of seeing sex in different way. Two different stories.
Thank you. Martha, do you care to respond at all about the recreation of semiotics at all?
You can see on YouTube and UbuWeb and so on, you can see the parodies of it. I think it's terrific that people want to appropriate work and make parodies and incorporate work. I mean, if sampling and copying are not part of our tradition, I don't know what it is. I mean, everybody's tradition. Theft. There was a whole recent conversation about Ian McEwan, supported and defended by his novelistic colleagues, who said, you can't accuse him of plagiarism. That's what we do. And I think it's a highly honorable and worthy of support and not commodification by Disney and so on. Mm-hmm. Though this makes it sound like I disagree with Marina. Of course, copying through ignorance is not okay, And it's completely absurd to take the work of one era and generation and act as though you had no idea it existed, but simply that you've reinvented it. But I see this in a slightly different way, which is that the people who are doing it are often literally reinventing it and just have had some kind of strained and pureed version of history presented to them. They have no idea what the context and depth of the material that they're that they've seen in little digital images really is, which is why I really hate presenting my work, because I'm always going to say something completely misleading about it, all the more so when we talk about the work of other people. And so even though I agreed to redo Semiotics of the Kitchen, it was never a live performance, and I just said, let's treat it as an audition in which other people make the work. So that's my thoughts on it.
I know we, we have another question.
I have a question about in France and then the two Indian artists, neither of whom I was familiar with before, so that's, but a completely different set of coordinates. And then Martha, your work in New York and San Diego. So I was just wondering if maybe, we could talk, or you could talk about the ways in which, sometimes the specificities of things in different cultures, but also just different localities, means that actually it can't all be translated into a shared language. I know that's the feminist, or one feminist dream is of a shared language, but I don't think we actually, maybe we don't even want that, and maybe part of what art is about. I mean, in a way, Marina, I saw your piece as being also about that estrangement or the impossibility of translating other knowledges, vernacular knowledges, into, say, an American or, broadly Western dominant popular cultural logic. And I wonder if there's something to be gained by actually not being fully able to understand each other or to inhabit fully the logic and worlds that each of you presented.
I just want to say that the one of the most interesting cultures for me, they're always the cultures which I can't compare with my own. That's what really inspired me the most. And I think that we should really actually embrace diversity and not try to make similar everything. Globalization is the worst thing on the world because we're losing identity. In one way there is a positive aspect, but a more negative on the other end. And I think the idea of completely the completely unknown cultures to let's say here, I feel there's so many unknown things for me. Like the old idea of the feminism here is, for me, I'm learning, because I'm totally something else. It just come from somewhere else. So I don't see the connection, but it's very interesting because it's diversity. I think we should really not put things together. You can't. And why should we?
Okay. Isn't that the thesis of Harold Bloom? Did I get that wrong? Yeah, art proceeding by a series of productive misunderstandings. I mean, I think, did I get that wrong? Sorry. Create. Sorry.
I just want to add something. Somebody is talking? No, somebody was talking?
Sorry.
No, just to say about diversity. I mean, how strange is this when the Christiana Amanpour come to the camp with a raped woman in Bosnia. She's running around with microphone in CNN, and she say, "Anybody rape here speak English?"
I just wanted to Beatrice have a chance to speak, and then we have one more question, and then I know we have to go on. Two questions. Okay. No. But I was hoping that Beatrice might have a chance to talk a little bit about Eileen Gray, or at least let us know about her in terms of her history as an architect. Have you also done work on her history, or how do you feel about talking about Corbusier and less about Gray?
Because the work has been done. The work has been done in many ways. It wouldn't have been even possible for me to look into this very precise episode of the history of Eileen Gray without the work of Peter Adams, who is his biographer and wrote a very detailed book of her life. And more recently, Caroline Constant have done a book by Phaidon Press on the architecture of Eileen Gray this was not what I set myself to do. I mean, I'm sure this discussion has happened in the art world many, many times before it came into architecture, that it's feminism or in architecture is not going to happen, let me tell you, by looking at the work of the few women architects that managed to make something. I mean, that's an interesting, you know, obviously it needs to be done, but that's not the only thing that needs to be done. Wasn't it Linda Nochlin who wrote about this about whether the feminism in art will come from writing the history of women artists or questioning the institutions? I mean, in that sense, for me, was more important to look into the great institution that is Le Corbusier and this completely unknown aspect of his practice, which has been entirely covered over, right? I mean, as much as if you want to know about Eileen Gray is not an architect, didn't train as an architect, then you could say, oh yeah, well then, okay, of course, it's not in histories of architecture, why we'll see. But think again, none of them were. Adolf Loos didn't finish his studies, Le Corbusier didn't go to architecture school, Mies didn't go to architecture school, and you go on and on, then none of them went to architecture school. So, I mean, in many ways, Eileen Gray is more qualified than all of them because she was trained as an artist. She trained in the Slade school, and then, of course, learned the technique of lacquer from a Japanese craftsman, and started her own business in Paris under a pseudonym, Jean Dessert, so that he would appear as a man is producing all this furniture. It was in this context that he met, I think, Badovici, who convinced her that he should try her hand at architecture. The interesting thing also about her history for me, I mean, one of the things that are more haunting for me and are not part of these other studies of Eileen Gray, is why is it that in the 20s, architectural magazine, architectural publication had no problem acknowledging Eileen Gray. In fact, there are entire issues dedicated to her work, Wendingen, L'Architecture d'aujourd'hui, L'Architecture vivant, the still international publications cover her work, her architectural work. What happened? I mean, how can it be that there is this amnesia from 1920 to maybe 1929 and that's it? Then she disappears. From here, are we going backwards? How did the whole story with Le Corbusier had something to do with it? This is part of what is haunting to me of that story. Other people can do monograph. I think it's very valuable work.
Thank you for your comments. Yes.
Thank you very much. I kind of wanted to go back to linking up actually with what Richard was questioning, which there is a very strong tradition within feminist studies in art history, which challenges the very concept of the category feminist art. It's a category of the museum because it's a draw to put people in, as if having said feminist, you've said all there is to say, just like you say it's cubist. Now, the point of studying art is to find out what it said that you didn't know before it said it, or what was put into the world, which requires a lot of work to get to the point. Because it's my very strong conviction that the terms of analysis we have that are contemporary with when the artwork is produced are about, at least predate that work, and certainly are probably out of date. So the terms of which the early work by feminists or by feminist interventions met the world, met a series of responses that were inadequate to them. So I do think there's a very interesting moment now of reflection where we have had 30 years of trying to produce terms of analysis that might be adequate to the kind of interventions that artworks are making. And so the category feminist art, trying to find coherence between them, is absolutely deadly. It's where the museum kills the point of art, which is to try and say something or invent something that will make us think differently. But in that case then, with that little preamble, I was fascinated by this panel because I kept working at different levels. One is the obvious thing everybody thinks about feminist work as a kind of critique of representation, and we have some kind of long aspect of it. But a person made a question this morning about audience and spectatorship, and that's what I wanted us to pick up on two, or three actually. actually all of them, but we won't go into that one. But in Marina, in your work, I was thinking about this question of the return of the pagan, the return of a certain symbolic or idea of the body as sacred. I've done work recently with various people in Africa where when women really, really wanted to frighten the Nigerian government, they threatened to take their clothes off because within a culture in which the body, and particularly the body of a mature woman, is considered sacred, it has a certain charge or power. Now, the idea, the belief system in which that operates, being translated into a video in which we then watched a lot of women show their vaginas to us, I was really, you know, caught by what it was that was going on there, given the use of video, given, as it were, spectacle, exposure, voyeurism, all those possibilities, old-fashioned sort of feminist questions. How, you know, that was set against then looking at what I found from Beatrice's presentation of, in a sense, the a kind of an allegorical relationship between the defacement of the house of Eileen Gray, the house that she actually created for herself in the inscription, literally being, as it were, defaced by this man occupying the body. So there was another way in which this idea of the house as the body of woman and the kind of these deeper structures, mythic structures, symbolic structures, as against certain kinds of literalizations, which do require us to have an analysis of the strategies of representation, of the strategies of disappearance. And I thought, Geeta Kapoor, you were also very much causing us to pay attention to the sort of historical political specificity in which an artist intervenes with that whole weight of a culture's mythic, symbolic, poetic, and often very misogynist elements in it. And of course, Martha's work is again a commentary on that through, as you were saying, another particular strategy of representation, photomontage. So I just wondered if we could get back from this idea somehow that there's a whole bunch of feminists who are united by something or some kind of expectation that they must have something common, as opposed not to discontinuity, but to strategies, strategic interventions by means of aesthetic practices that that pick up on the immediates of the political, obviously, in your particular situation, Marina, coming out of a particular history in calling it the Balkans, but in terms of all your work has been very much rooted in finding a language for a certain kind of political experience in history. And yet they are rooted in some larger symbolic mythic legacies that any act of representation sort of hits at the same point. So I wondered if we could bring something out, because the body and this is such an important panel in terms of one of the major things that women asking questions and women asking questions have, but it's probably the most difficult. Yeah. And that rather than see you all as just, you know, light bulbs going off in different sorts of places, I did feel there were some very deep questions there about how we address the legacies of meaning in political as well as sort of symbolic mythic terms of the female body. And I was perplexed in relation particularly to the scenes of showing the organs. Are the organs, when they're seen, as potent as when people have these ideas about the power of the body and even have customs and gestures, such as touching or putting, you know, menstrual blood or putting a fish in your vagina? I mean, all of these things are not quaint folkloric things. And we probably do the same now because we just don't do it, but everybody has to make their bodies more powerful by surgery or something like that. These are still there. So I'm rambling now, but I was just trying to hold on to political specificity and this deeper sort of symbolic mythopoetic resonance that seemed to move across all of the papers.
I think on the contrary, if I might say so, you're not rambling. You're actually putting together the afternoon's session into not translating one into the other, but actually asking for a discursive space in which all these ways of dealing with the issue of body and sexuality can be placed. I would just like to say that I ended with suggesting that I would like to translate what seems to me a slightly stereotypical / which is body sexuality identity, the title of this afternoon session, which I found somewhat predictable, somewhat stereotyped. I think the first instance would be to actually translate, if not also even subvert, this kind of a formulation of body sexuality identity. And that would be one way to address other kinds of questions which have come out of precisely having addressed these questions in an earlier decade. So that if this was valid, this kind of a configuration was valid at 2 decades ago, then one should have moved on to be able to create other discursive spaces. And I fairly spontaneously at the end of my red paper said that I would be interested in thinking in terms of citizenship, gender, and language, which in some senses shifts the subject away and allows one to intervene from different historical and political positions, and if I might just take a minute, half a minute longer, I find it very, very surprising when people live in metropolises like New York speak about difference, strangeness, and translation as though it were being talked about for the first time. I mean, this is a world which is... I'm not talking about Richard saying it. I'm speaking about how, in actual fact, that is the mode of reception. And one of the things I said yesterday at a dinner held for us is that it is, for example, a terrible disadvantage that in a gathering like this, I would be one of the only persons who'd come from a region different from the Euro-American continents, which means that one bears the responsibility both of presenting difference and then in some way translating that difference to an audience that is preset to recognize strangeness but not commonalities. And I would think that the discursive as well as the visual presentation that I might make would be in terms of, as much in terms of the commonality of commitments and ideology as it would be in terms of the different sign systems used. And I would suggest that one should be taking those both those on board simultaneously.
I'm happy.
I just say that I think it's perhaps not so visible that Marina is also representing a position of otherness with...
I was just saying that we should actually take account of the fact that Marina is speaking from a position of difference within the discourse of the Euro-American, and in fact that the Balkan area has always been put into a very particular category, and her work very potently tries to address that without necessarily leaving the translation visible, but rather to present it as a problematic area.
I just wanted to ask one question.
No, I'm sorry.
We have
gone way over. We also have Catherine DeZager has a response and a special presentation. We're really infringing on her rights as an artist as well. And we did announce that the former question was the last one. I'm very happy that it was one that did bring the discussion to a little bit more of a closure. We have a reception after the response, and please come up and talk to all the panelists
more
about
the public is holy. They have to ask the questions. Maybe just to give them a little chance. It's so important.
Oh, now we have to take a vote.
Just a short questions. Come on.
Is there a session that allows the audience to have more
Come on.
Say?
Ask.
No. I'm so sorry. It's time to go. Thank you so much.
Listen, as a very old time throwback to the 70s, I would like to point out that
this is still the Kremlin of modernism, and that we are still elevated way above you, and that one of the things that feminism and everybody else in the 70s who had any sense in the 60s was trying to say is that when we have a gathering like this with such interested and often august people in the audience, that you shouldn't just be an audience. So I'm a little heartbroken. So.
Well, we've got another day. We've got a reception. Let's mix it all up.
What about really break all conventions and have another three questions, and then we go to another one? I mean, come on. Why not breaking rules?
No, you know, it sounds like a great idea, but it will really ruin Catherine's presentation. Yeah. And as an artist, I would think you'd respect that. Thank you.